Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is a continuation of a series of podcasts that we're doing on the subject of intelligent medicine. That means the best of high-tech medicine and the best of natural medicine. Podcasts are available to you via the website, drhoffman.com, and it's real fun doing these, and I hope that these podcasts contribute to your store of information about medicine, health, and nutrition. This is just the beginning of a series that I hope we will continue for a very long time to come. I want to start today's podcast by talking about something that happened to me this week, kind of interesting. I got a phone call from a reporter at the British newspaper, The Guardian. The Guardian, of course, in the news these days because of the big story that they broke with that guy Snowden, who's hanging out in Hong Kong, who outed the government for snooping on U.S. citizens, and it's caused a big uproar. And so, of course, I kind of kidded around with this reporter. I said, how'd you find out about me? Are you going to tell me about how the government has completely downloaded all my files and that I've been the victim of government surveillance? And he said, no, kind of laughed. And he said, I'm actually calling you because I want your nutritional and medical expertise. I looked you up. You're a medical nutritionist, and we want you to comment on a story that's in the news that we're going to do a feature on. And it has to do with a woman in Seattle whose name is Navina Shine. I don't think that's her real name. It's like Sunshine, S-H-I-N-E. She's age 65. And she is someone who is in the process of trying to prove that you can go breatharian, as in breathing air alone, to survive. She's already been fasting on just water and a little bit of herbal tea since May 3rd. And she's out to prove that humans can subsist on water and sunlight. And she's documenting her efforts via social media on Facebook and on YouTube. She's trying to demonstrate that breatharianism is the real deal, that you can actually, through sheer will alone, turn your body around so that you can utilize air and sunlight, just like plants. In a Facebook post on May 3rd, she wrote, quote, "Plants live on light. Then we eat plants. Are we simply not accessing our inherent ability to live on light?" And she's got a website where she talks about this. It's called Living on Light. Living on Light. And there she expounds in great detail about her theory about how we could break free of material entanglements. She writes, and I'm quoting, "Can you imagine if we did not have to eat, just how free our lives would be? A vast amount of time, effort, and resources go into merely putting food on the table. If humans did not have to eat, we could turn our planet back into a place of beauty. Our land could return to its pristine state, used for pleasure rather than need. Animals could be treated with respect. Time could be utilized for pleasure rather than the grind of work. Chemicals in the soil would no longer be needed, and neither would all the destruction from the highly mechanized food industries." So she's out to prove that this is feasible. And the reporter from The Guardian wanted my medical opinion on whether this was A, feasible, and B, advisable. So I'm here to tell you that according to the basic laws of physiology, if you believe in science and all that we know, that this is it's a non-starter. It's not going to happen, because if you look at human evolution, or actually the evolution of life on the planet, about a couple of billion years ago, the earliest one-celled organisms, which were neither plants nor animals, evolved into two main types. One were the plants, or the precursors to modern plants, probably algae, green algae floating around the sea, and the others were the small one-celled or few-celled organisms that were the precursors of animals. And there was a basic difference between them. The precursors to the plants were green, and they had chlorophyll. And chlorophyll is a remarkable little molecule. It's got magnesium at its center, and it has the ability to take sunlight and convert the sunlight, the energy of the sunlight, into energy that can drive the life of the plant. And all the plant requires to make that happen is a little bit of carbon dioxide, which is a waste product of our breathing. We actually require oxygen. Plants recycle the carbon dioxide that we give off. And probably a few nutrients that the plant derives from its root system. But except for certain plants like Venus flytraps and pitcher plants, and those types of plants actually augment their diet with a little bit of animal protein. But for the vast majority, those are sort of an outlier. The vast majority of plants don't need to eat food to survive, notwithstanding the fact that we feed our plants with Miracle-Gro. Those are sort of minerals and things that actually help sustain the plant's growth. But the plant doesn't need to eat as we traditionally do. Humans, on the other hand, as do all animals, require fuel in the form of food that we convert into energy by oxidizing it. We use oxygen to burn our fuel. And instead of having chloroplasts containing chlorophyll, we have mitochondria, which are the energy-producing components of our cells. Plants have chloroplasts, we have mitochondria. And in the mitochondria, we burn, and actually this is a bit of a heat-producing process, but it's a controlled burn. We burn either fat, or we can burn carbohydrates to provide us with fuel. So what happens when you go into a starvation state? Well, for a little while, when you don't eat, fasting a short period of time, like overnight or for a few hours, you have glycogen. Glycogen gets stored in your liver. It also gets stored in your muscles. And then that is a form of readily available carbohydrate that you can use, even though you're not taking in carbohydrates. What happens when your glycogen gets used up? Well, you feel cranky and irritable. If you're an athlete running a race, you hit the proverbial wall. And then you have to actually start breaking down your fat, which is good if you're on a diet. But if you're going to try and do it for 40 days or so, you break down your fats. And then pretty soon you lose your fat reserves. And then you need to start attacking your protein. So that's not particularly good because all your organs, your brain, your heart, your internal organs are made of protein. Your muscles especially are made of protein. And you begin a process of catabolism or muscle breakdown, which is a wasting away process that typically people who starve undergo. And that is not a good process. That's not something that ultimately is conducive to long-term survival. There have been experiments of nature and experiments of history where people have been imprisoned or starved or concentration camps or shipwrecked. These are circumstances in which people have lived extraordinarily long times. I don't know what the Guinness World Record is, or some people have done self-imposed fasts. Maybe there's a record book somewhere that records that. But around a few weeks, or certainly by a very few months, people go downhill rapidly. And then here we're talking about the macronutrients. We're talking about protein, fat, and carbohydrates, the major nutrients in our diet. But the micronutrients also are important because we can pretty quickly become deficient in, say, vitamin C and develop a nutritional deficiency disease called scurvy. We can be deficient in vitamin D and develop rickets. We can be deficient in essential fatty acids and develop very dry skin and our hair falls out. That's essential fatty acid deficiency. Zinc deficiency, we'll get skin peeling. Vitamin A deficiency, we'll develop serious eye problems. And so on and so on it goes. So you're deficient in macronutrients, you're deficient in micronutrients. Bad stuff will eventually happen, even if we think good thoughts, meditate, and try to transcend our physical limitations. And I shared with the reporter on The Guardian that the whole thing is reminiscent of a short story that I read in college called The Hunger Artist, by the German author Franz Kafka. He wrote very ironic short stories. And in this short story, the hunger artist is part of a carnival, an itinerant carnival. They went from town to town in Germany. And he was carted around in a circus cage, one of those things, horse-drawn cage, that where he sat on straw like a wild animal. But his performance was simply to sit there and starve. And so he'd go from village to village. The villagers would gawk at him and taunt him with food, but he would exercise tremendous restraint and not eat the food and scowl back at the villagers. And the story goes on as he proceeds to break his own record again and again and again. And finally, he goes to a village where he exceeds his record by 40 days. But he notices that after 40 days, the villagers become bored with his act, and he becomes increasingly listless, doesn't get hardly any attention at all. Even the little kids who used to come up to the cage avoid him now. And finally, one day, he just lay down in the straw, never to wake up again. And after the hunger artist expired, they took his body away. But they replaced him with a more popular act, which was they put a panther in the cage, and the panther would sit there and snarl at the onlookers. It was a great favorite of the carnival. Was always very happy to receive a scrap of meat or some food thrown into the cage by one of the spectators. And that's how the story ends, in kind of an ironic way. And that, unfortunately, may be the way the story ends for our Miss Shine in Seattle. A peculiar choice of geography for undertaking an experiment on how we can survive on sunlight. Seattle being one of the rainiest, cloudiest places in the United States. I'm not quite sure how she's going to pull it off up there. But another observation is that as people starve, they tend to get into somewhat of a euphoric state. You reach a point where I've done this for 11 days at a time, and you get a little euphoric. And there's actually a physiological explanation for that. You start to generate lots of endorphins. These are internal opiates, kind of like a runner's high. When you're exposed to pain or, you know, with extreme exertion or with starvation, your body generates endorphins to help you overcome the suffering and deprivation. And this is why people become anorexic, is they get a little high and they get a sense of almost a rapturous sense when they put themselves in a starvation state. So, we hope that somebody intervenes if Ms. Shine decides to go off the deep end and do herself grievous harm. But the bottom line, as I expressed it to the reporter from The Guardian, is please don't try this at home. And if it continues for too long, it's going to not end well for our intrepid would-be breatharian. Okay, here's another story that I shared with you a few months ago. It's a very, very weird story, but it's becoming of increasing importance because this problem, while once rare, is becoming more common. It's red meat allergy. And that's pretty weird because traditionally, when we think of allergy, we think of allergies to food like wheat and dairy and perhaps eggs. Certainly we know about nut allergies that can even be fatal. Shellfish allergies, very dangerous. Sometimes people have allergies to other foods like eggs and tomatoes and so on. Sometimes citrus fruit. But generally we don't think of animal protein as being something that causes allergies. Generally well tolerated. People are rarely allergic to turkey or to chicken. More often to fish, but certainly red meat, that's a very, very, very uncommon allergy. And yet, researchers are now closing on an increasingly common phenomenon of red meat allergy, and they think they've found a culprit. So that's an exciting story in medicine because pretty quickly they drew a bead on this. The first cases of this unusual allergy were identified at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville in 2007, and they're now being reported as far north as Nantucket, Massachusetts, and on the east end of New York's Long Island. There's a big story on this in the Wall Street Journal this week, June 14th. And they interview a pediatric and adult allergist in East Hampton, New York, Dr. Erin McGinty, who says, quote, "It's a huge problem out here." She knows of more than 70 cases, and she sees several more each week. She says, quote, "I've been trying to get the word out, but there are still a lot of people who don't believe it." She cites the case of Tony Piazza, who's a landscape designer in Southampton, New York. He first woke up in the middle of the night gasping for breath and covered in hives 6 years ago. So they took him to the emergency room at Southampton Hospital and gave him the usual treatment for allergic reaction, intravenous antihistamines, and said, well, it's an allergic reaction, but they couldn't figure out precisely what it was. Often you can't determine the cause of an allergic reaction. But he kept having the problem two or three times a year for the next few years. And he started to notice, sometimes these things are hard to pin down, but he noticed that the reaction occurred every time he ate lamb for dinner, even though he never had food allergies before. Then he noticed that it happened with steak and then hamburger. So he says, quote, "I swore off red meat completely and the reaction stopped." Now, researchers at the University of Virginia have discovered that they looked at people who had an allergic reaction to a cancer drug. It's called cetuximab. And the researchers found that there was a marker for that particular type of allergy in the blood. It's called alpha-gal, spelled A-L-P-H-A-gal, G-A-L. And it's present in the drug, and it also happens to be present in mammalian meat. So meat from mammals, that would include, you know, I guess beef, pork, lamb, you know, whale, seal, dog, horse, you name it. Those are all mammals. And I guess, you know, if you're a human cannibal, you know, you could get it too. So, you know, don't become a cannibal. Alpha-gal is something that it occurs, the reaction occurs in people who've had tick exposure. All right, so it's regional. It occurs throughout the eastern and southern United States, and it's transmitted by a tick, but not the same tick that that causes Lyme disease. Also, it's not curable with antibiotics. It's an allergic reaction after you've been bitten by the tick, and it may dissipate after a few years so that you can then regain the ability to eat red meat. But some people continue to be sensitive to red meat. It's unclear why. The tick that is responsible, unlike the deer tick, which is a small tick, very, very tiny, that can fit on the head of a pin, the deer tick is a little bigger. It's more like a nail head size. And these are often ticks that you find on dogs. They have a hard body and they have a little star on them. They're called Lone Star ticks. And after you get bitten by this tick, not inevitably, but sometimes these tick bites trigger the creation of the antibodies to alpha-gal. And so there is now a blood test available. So if you think you start to do some detective where you think, every time I eat red meat, I'm getting that allergic reaction, you can see, you know, usually it will require that you see a professional allergist, although I'm doing this test now in my office. Get the test. Find out if you have the allergy to red meat, and especially if you are someone who might have picked ticks out of your socks after hiking, because that would be a source of exposure. If you've got pets, for example, maybe that, you know, one tick jumped off a pet, jumped on you or your child, and you too could be suffering from an alpha-gal sensitivity causing allergy to red meat. It's a fascinating phenomenon, and it's newly recognized, but something that we need to be aware of. So far, no cure is looming on the horizon, except avoidance of red meat. That seems to be the answer. you know, one of our continual themes here on Intelligent Medicine is that it's best to use a natural approach whenever possible, because medicines, even medicines that work for various conditions, in some cases have very weird or unusual or unforeseen side effects. And so it is with the story that I came across recently, headline, Milton teacher accused of unlawful conduct with student may blame Parkinson's medication. This is a weird instance of how a guy with no previous history of pedophilia or deviant behavior suddenly seems to have had a personality change and is now in a heap of trouble. Here's the story. This is from Milton, Connecticut. The attorney for a Milton High School teacher said prescription drugs were at the root of his arrest. A 14-year-old student has accused 64-year-old Dale Snyder of sexual assault. According to police, on June 2nd, Snyder and the student were helping put away chairs after graduation when the teacher invited the girl back to his classroom. There, according to the girl, Snyder put his hand on her leg, then kissed her several times. He's now charged with indecent assault and battery on a child over 14 and assault and battery. So, you know, you think, well, this is an ordinary case. I mean, you hear about cases like this all the time, right? You know, the high school teacher getting a little bit too familiar with the student. And, you know, that's all there is to it. End of story. You know, this guy's in a heap of trouble. According to this guy's attorney, and, you know, some may scoff at this, you know, not knowing the medical facts, but Snyder's attorney, Thomas Lawton, said his client suffers from Parkinson's disease, and the medication he takes may cause impulsive behavior. So they're going to try and work a medical defense into the case. All right, I am going to share with you a story of a patient that I saw who was suffering from restless leg syndrome. And in restless leg syndrome, they sometimes give patients Parkinson's medications, things like Mirapex, medications with similar names. And the patient said, and the patient was there for me to treat her restless leg syndrome. It turned out that her restless leg syndrome had a lot to do with an iron deficiency, because if you have low iron, you're much more prone to restless leg syndrome. Sometimes just supplementing iron in patients alleviates their restless leg syndrome. Magnesium helps too, but restless leg is not just leg spasm. It's a very uncomfortable, inability to sit still. But anyway, the standard treatment for restless leg syndrome, by the way, restless leg syndrome is a relatively newly invented disease. I mean, it's a real condition and it's miserable for those who have it, but there wasn't a lot of awareness about it until they developed drugs that originally were used for Parkinson's disease and then received an indication that they could be used for restless leg syndrome. Because there's only, you know, perhaps a million people with Parkinson's disease, quite a few, but there's a heck of a lot more people who have some form of restless leg syndrome. So they thought to extend the applicability of these medications to patients with not full-blown Parkinson's, but just this movement disorder of the leg. So a lot of patients without Parkinson's were getting these Parkinson's drugs with some pretty weird side effects. I mean, ordinarily these medications are well tolerated, but dopamine, which is what these medications rev up, is the neurochemical in the brain that is responsible for desire and reward, okay, and motivation, in fact. So, you know, if you don't have enough dopamine, you're sort of flat, listless, you lose interest in life. But if your dopamine is overly revved up, you suddenly become overly stimulated. You can become highly addicted because the reward center of your brain is revved up. So you're constantly seeking reward. Well, reward could be in the form of food, if that's your particular gig. You may end up stuffing your face in an uncontrolled fashion. But sometimes this out-of-control behavior takes the form of a change in your sexual habits. So and there are cases, documented cases, of staid monogamous wives or husband suddenly becoming sex fiends, embarking on multiple affairs, or becoming addicted to pornography because of these types of medications. Alternatively, people develop gambling addiction. I mean, what is more reward and reinforcement than going to a slot machine or rolling the dice? And so there are cases of people who, you know, never really wanted to gamble before. Maybe they played a couple of hands at canasta or something. But after taking these Parkinson's drugs, they take off to Atlantic City or Las Vegas and lose a fortune. So I saw a patient, and she told me her unhappy tale. She said that she had been placed on this Parkinson's medication, and she said that she lost $250,000 gambling. And I said, well, really, what form of gambling did that take? Was it high-stakes poker, or was it, you know, the slot machines? She said, no. She said, it was those scratch-off lottery cards. And I said, you're kidding. How can one possibly lose $250,000? She said, you just buy them all day long, and you scratch them and scratch them and scratch them and scratch them. And she expended virtually her entire family fortune buying those cards day in, day out, until it was realized that it was the medication that was causing a problem. And you know what? It was interesting, because she realized it was a side effect of the medication. She probably consulted with a doctor. The doctor said, yeah, that can happen. She then consulted an attorney who proceeded to file a lawsuit against the company that makes the medication. And I said, well, did it go to court? Did you have a court case, you know, to go to a trial with a jury? She says, no, they settled immediately. They recognized that the case was a loser. They probably write off a certain percentage of their profits in rewards to the smallest percentage of patients, albeit that this is a rare reaction. I mean, it may occur, you know, less than 1% of the time, but it occurs if thousands of people are taking these medications, or perhaps millions. This is going to happen quite a few times across the country in one form or another. And so they just wrote her a check for whatever, you know, $257,000. End of story. They had, you know, admitted culpability, maybe had her, you know, sign a confidentiality agreement to keep the case quiet. But that's the deal. These medications, it is a plausible legal defense for this guy. If he has Parkinson's disease and he's taking this medication and he has a clean record before with no unbecoming conduct towards minors, and all of a sudden after taking this medication, he starts to get a little hot and heavy with his 14-year-old student, that this plausibly could be a side effect of the medication. It goes down in the annals of side effects as one of the more weird ones, but it goes to show you that sometimes unforeseen consequences when you take seemingly innocuous medications. And finally, on today's program, we're going to talk a little bit about yoga. You know, we often talk about aerobic exercise and exploits of strength training, but you don't need to be involved in heroic forms of exercise to get a boost to your brain power, according to a recent study. This is a study was performed at Wayne State University in Detroit. According to the author of the study, Dr. Neha Gotha, who's a professor of exercise physiology at Wayne State University, yoga is an ancient Indian science and a way of life that includes not only physical movements and postures, but also regulated breathing and meditation. So, you know, just a comment, a sidebar here. I think that what we've done is we've taken yoga out of its context in the United States. We've made it into sort of a real heavy-duty exertion, something that involves feats of great strength and endurance. And we're less, we sort of divorced it from its original context, which is that it's a complete system for helping to regulate the autonomic nervous system, the nervous system that's associated with breathing, but it also is responsible for digestion and heart rate and blood pressure and all the involuntary activities of our bodies. So in this study, What they found is that doing yoga for as little as 20 minutes per day may be able to boost your brain power. Subjects in the study who participated in a single yoga session had better speed and accuracy scores on working memory. Well, they said just a single, it's not even day in, day out. It's just one yoga session, and they had better performance on tests measuring brain power, better than after they tried an aerobic exercise session of the same length. So these tests reflect a person's ability to maintain focus as well as absorb and remember new information. And my goodness, we could all use a little more of that in our busy lives that are beset with attention deficit disorder. So an additional story related to this is that as part of our efforts to heal wounded warriors who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, they're investigating yoga as part of a Defense Department funded study looking into how the ancient science can provide relaxation, focus, and stress relief to GIs returning from foreign wars who suffer from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. 8.7% of U.S. adults, or around 20 million people, practice yoga in the United States. And an additional 44% of Americans, perhaps you are included among them, are aspirational yogis and want to try yoga. So, you know, if you're open to yoga, consider doing it. It's very, very beneficial. And it, you know, particularly, even if you construe it as a way of staying flexible, I think when we think of a balanced exercise program, we've got to think of several components. One, of course, aerobic, the aerobic component where you raise your heart rate and sustain it. You know, that could be running, cycling, it could be walking at a rapid clip. It could be using Stairmaster or something along those lines. But then there's strength training, you know, where you use weights, resistance training. That's good for building your muscles, strengthening your bones. Then there's what's called plyometrics, which is jumping, you know, and you know that's a different thing in terms of enhancing your overall fitness. But yoga and stretching are very, very important components of your exercise portfolio. So the hypothesis is that you improve your self-awareness through yoga's meditational aspects, and you can dissipate anxiety and stress. And you know, one of the main things I think it really gets in the way of brain performance is if you're anxious, if you if your brain isn't quiet, it's hard to bring ideas into focus and to bring bring memories out of the deep folds of your brain. So an ideal companion to for students or for people who want to perform better in their jobs, or if you just overall want to do better on a crossword puzzle or play better bridge, make sure that you consider yoga as part of your overall exercise portfolio. It's never too late to start, and it's something that I'm doing more and more of. Well, thanks very much for joining us for today's Intelligent Medicine. Please feel free to download more of our podcast if you like what you're hearing, and also listen to us live when our regular radio program on Clear Channel Radio, WOR Network, is heard on weekends. You can check it out at WR710.com. That's where the podcasts are for that radio program. Go to our website at drhoffman.com for additional information. And you can subscribe, if you haven't already, to our great newsletter. It's the Intelligent Medicine newsletter. And the way to get that is to email us, radioprogram@AOL.com, ask for a subscription to the newsletter, and we'll make sure that you're apprised of all the latest information that we send out via email. Thanks for joining us, and until our next Intelligent Medicine podcast, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us.